Welcome today to an interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jerry Gertner, international leader in IT security and forensics, governance, and auditing. Jerry, God, you just have an amazing background, so thank you for sharing your work and experiences with our audience.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you today, Stephen. Thank you for speaking to me.
Now, Jerry, again, as I mentioned, an incredible history of success. You've done a lot. Can you quickly profile or list some of your major roles?
For sure. I'm originally a Montrealer. I was born in Montreal and went to high school there. After that, I went to MIT as an undergraduate, spent 5 years there. I had a brief stint at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, but the school and I did not agree, so that ended rather precipitously. I then came back to Montreal and joined the Pricewaterhouse accounting firm and spent many years there. And simultaneously, I was at McGill University, first as a student in the Chartered Accountancy Program, and then as an instructor. From Pricewaterhouse in Montreal, I joined Pricewaterhouse National Office and eventually ended up in the Toronto office. I left Pricewaterhouse in 1992, I think, formed my own business, a company that provided consulting services in privacy and cryptography and biometrics, and that was very early on for privacy consulting. My partner and I managed to land a really nice contract providing services to the city of Toronto, and they were one of our major clients for quite a while. Then I did a bit of a switch, and I went off to art school for a few years before joining a trustee and bankruptcy firm, where I worked first as an accountant and then as a trustee in bankruptcy. And that firm merged with another firm, and somewhere in that process, I managed to write 3 books actually on bankruptcy, which were published. And I guess about 5-6 years ago, I returned to my first love, which is information technology, strategy, assurance, governance, and founded a department within the firm where I work, and I've been doing that pretty well ever since. Last 3 or 4 years as well, I've been quite involved with the Canadian Information Processing Society, and I'm currently the president of the Ontario Provincial Society.
I'm exhausted. I can't believe all the things you've done. It's just, and with great success. So, and it's going to provide a remarkable interview because you have so much to share. Now, from this long history of success, can you perhaps choose 3 pivotal moments and then maybe some usable lessons from each one of these moments?
I'll try and keep it down to 3. There seem to have been quite a number in my career. I think the first lesson event has to do with when I first joined Pricewaterhouse as a very junior accountant, really not knowing anything about auditing or business at all, because my focus up to that point had been in technology and actually brain science and medicine. And I started doing financial audits, and this was back in the late 60s, early 70s. And very quickly, I determined that they weren't being done properly, at least not in my opinion. They certainly weren't being done efficiently. So I started to incorporate some computer technology and started to do things with computers. And more and more, I've started focusing on the computerized portion of accounting systems and controls and security, and less on the financial accounting component. I was an outlier in doing that. I was one of the first people who actually started to do that. And I think one of the lessons that I learned, or that I brought from that period in my career and my life, is, first of all, if you see an opportunity, see a way to do something better, no matter if you're the most junior employee or the most senior, you should at least give it a shot. You should try to improve things. The lesson that goes with that is, it's often easier to ask for forgiveness and permission. When people see success, they're willing to overlook a lot, but if you try and explain something to an audience that really is not sensitive to that topic, sometimes it's very difficult to get them on side. Another lesson I took away from that whole process is, change is very slow, and people are resistant to new ideas if they're not presented very carefully, in a very non-threatening way. And I found that over and over again. I was a very, junior employee, and I was dealing with the most senior managers and partners, and I, in essence, had to tell them they were doing things the wrong way, or there was a different and better way to do their audits and their financial accounting and their risk assessment. And it took a while before I think I got it down right, where I could communicate what needed to be communicated. communicated without making them feel as if they were inadequate or they didn't know what they were doing or I was being an arrogant upstart, etc., etc. So I would say something that came out of that whole period also is how important it is to know your audience and communicate the message appropriate way. I'm going to jump forward now to when I left Pricewaterhouse, which was many years later in the early 90s, and I formed a company with a partner called Data Privacy Partner. And we were both at that time, he and I, very, very interested in the privacy space. I think we came at it from both a technological and a human rights perspective. Both of our personalities were oriented that way. And it was the first time that I had been involved with a startup. And again, this was a startup in a very unusual area. In the early 90s, people didn't understand cryptography and they really didn't understand privacy. So one of the things that I took away from that whole period, a lot of lessons with respect to startups, how difficult it is to actually get a business off the ground, how important it is, extremely important to have a partner or partners with complementary talent. I think I also learned that you know, knowing your stuff is, I mean, a prerequisite, but it's certainly not enough to make a business grow. You have to be a financier and a marketer and an administrator. You have to understand your clients very, very well. And sometimes the clients didn't really understand what services they actually needed. And that's a very difficult situation, not unlike the situation in Montreal, where the audit partners, for example, didn't understand the importance of computer audit because it hadn't yet become mainstream. So those were some things I took away from my experience with data processing, with the data privacy rather, the need for a good partner and the need to know your clients, and I guess also that the need to balance your business processes with you know, agility and the ability to respond rapidly and effectively. The last of these pivotal moments, as you call them, probably would be when I got my trustee license. And for those of your listeners who don't know, a trustee is an officer of the court with quasi-judicial powers. Some people think a trustee actually has more powers than a judge, and in some ways, a trustee does. And, you know, working as a trustee assistant or working in the field is one thing, but when you get that piece of paper, and suddenly you literally have the power to be judge and jury over someone's life to decide if they stay in their house or not, if they lose their business or not, how much of their income is going to go to the court, and how much they're going to have left feed their family, you start to look at, well, the legal system, work, you know, personal responsibility very, very differently. That was a very eye-opening experience for me. I mean, some of the things I learned from my clients, my bankruptcy clients, people have a tendency to be willfully blind if things are bad. They just don't look and they don't look. And finally, things become absolutely insupportable. But I was amazed at how long people had juggled their finances or borrowed money from friends and family, really, where the situation was obviously hopeless, but they could not accept that, you know, they needed to do this thing, go bankrupt or to reorganize their finances, so they just kept sinking and sinking until circumstances forced them to look at reality. The other part of that lesson, which was also very, very interesting, was that probably 90% of my clients found the reality of being a trustee in bankruptcy, the reality of going bankrupt, as much less difficult and much less onerous and horrible than they had contemplated. People tend to overstress the negative or listen to rumors and not really look at the fact. Most of my clients ended up leaving my office after signing the legal papers declaring bankruptcy, feeling as if a huge burden had been lifted from their shoulders, not feeling as if the world had ended. And that was one of the rewarding parts of the job. I actually felt as a trustee I was really able to help people. And most people don't think of being a bankruptcy trustee in that way, but it really can be. So those are my three pivotal experiences and some of the lessons that I learned.
Well, those are excellent lessons to pass on to the audience. And, you know, you talked about bankruptcy and being a trustee. So what are the five top reasons for business failures?
Well, I have to qualify my answer and say that the reasons are different depending on the business, the locality, the economy, the circumstances. But if I had to generalize, I would say probably poor planning and unrealistic expectation is number one. Not not having sufficient financing behind you, expecting that you're going to open your doors the next day, the money's going to start rolling in, and not preparing for 6 months before you have your first sale. That's another reason that businesses fail. I mean, both new businesses and existing businesses often fail because they don't really understand their customer, or they don't see that needs are changing. And you go back to the old buggy whip business at the turn of the last century. The buggy whip manufacturers that just kept manufacturing buggy whips, not recognizing that the horseless carriage was going to take over from the horse. And had they opened their eyes and said, well, maybe we should be making accoutrements for a car as opposed to accoutrements for a buggy, they might still have been busy. So not knowing your customer and not observing changes in the environment, I think, are very important. Another one, it's a little less obvious, is not measuring your results properly, or possibly even not knowing what to measure. I can't tell you how many times I had clients come in, business people, whose sales targets, for example, weren't being met. And they came and they said, my business is failing because I had to sell $1 million worth of goods and I only sold $750,000. And if I could only get that extra $250,000 in sales, I would be just fine. My business would be just fine. Except you sit down with them and you look at the numbers in the financial statement for an hour or two, and you realize that every widget that they're selling, they're not making money. They're losing money. And had they sold $1 million worth of widgets, they would have, in fact, lost more money than they did when they sold $750,000 worth of widgets. So that's a case where management really didn't understand how much money they were making or losing, or how to cost their business processes, or how to interpret or measure the financial results. And as a consequence, they were trying harder and harder, in essence, to dig a deeper hole. So measurement is really, really important. I think probably the last of the five reasons would be related to the owners. Owners tend to be good inventors or good marketing people or good administrators, or have a really, interesting idea with a lot of intellectual property potential, but they're not necessarily all things. And many, many owners are very possessive, obviously, of their new business, and they don't recognize when they need help, and they don't recognize their own limitations. And that's very often a cause for failure. A really great product, a really great idea, a really great, marketing plan is not any good if you haven't got a CFO in place, if you haven't got financial controls in place, if you haven't got the financing, if you haven't got a good lawyer who's doing your intellectual property protection, if you haven't got back-end administrators who are doing your bank reconciliation so you know how much cash you have in the bank. So I think the last of the reasons would be owners, senior people not recognizing their own limitations, not recognizing how the parts of a business come together, and when they need help, not being able to let go.
It struck me when you were describing that sort of story about buggy whips and automobiles sort of wiping that whole business out, but I guess it's sort of continue doing those environmental scans of not only of your customers, but the internal or the external environment. And it kind of reminds me of the stories of Nintendo, Nokia, right? So I believe Nintendo made barrels or something like that. And now they're one of the world's largest gaming companies. And of course, Nokia, I think if they were in boots or rubber, making rubber products of some sort, and of course, they became one of the world's largest mobile companies. So.
And you can extend that, actually. But Nokia wasn't watching what the cellular market was asking for. So Android arose, and all of a sudden, people are asking. The headline in Bloomberg Business Report a couple of issues ago was, will Nokia survive? And when, Nokia has now taken their strategy and aligned themselves with Windows, but it's up in the air whether the formerly the world's largest cell phone company will even survive, because they didn't keep up with what their customers were asking for.
And I guess you could also extend that to BlackBerry and RIM and sort of the challenges they're experiencing right now. So
I would say so, yeah. You always, particularly in technology, you always have to know who your competition is, what your customers, prospective customers want, and which direction the wind is blowing, I would say, as well. I mean, unless you're Steve Jobs and you, in essence, create your own wind, which is a unique talent, an incredible talent, then you do have to know where you fit in the technological ecosystem, scientific ecosystem, whatever.
And I'm glad you brought up Steve Jobs, because he was kind of responsible for some really disruptive changes in the marketplace, and kind of leads to my next question. What are the disruptive technologies, and how will they have impact?
Oh, there are so many of them. From the perspective of information technology, I think the biggest disruptive technologies on the horizon are sort of the web 3.0 semantic web searching context kind of technologies and the expert systems and the artificial intelligence systems, the IBM Watson kind of system, which I think are going to revolutionize the way we live our lives. Robotic, quantum computing, nanotechnology are all also going to affect information technology by making what's now ubiquitous even more ubiquitous and even more portable. I think we're going to find we're living in a very different society 10, 20, 50 years from now, constantly connected, constantly having access to a substantial portion of the globe's intellectual resources, constantly knowing where your friends and your family are located. You know, you look at, you know, crowdsourcing and the variance now in research and marketing and finance. We're really creating new social structure with this technology as well as everything else. I've done a particular study about the future of technology on the professions. It's something near and dear to my heart since I've been a chartered accountant for many years, and I've been in the court environment, the legal environment, as a trustee for many years, and my little stint in medical school as well. And I tend to keep up with the medical profession, and I believe those three professions in particular are going to be very strongly affected by technology. And I've been writing quite a lot and doing presentations, basically trying to alert the professions that they're not keeping up with the technological change. And I really think it's going to be critical, particularly for the lawyers and the accountants. I see changes in the way lawyers are trained. I mean, we're already seeing changes with respect to rights for exclusive practice. We're seeing e-discovery. We're seeing the automation of the court process. We're seeing the ability to do, you know, terabyte data analysis in massive litigation cases so that things that would have taken years or even decades can be accomplished now in minutes or hours. And we're also seeing, as computers are becoming smarter, that a lot of that mid-level paper-pushing kind of work that lawyers do, the filling out forms and drafting affidavits and basic agreements and basic research, I'm pretty sure that most or all of that is going to be done by computers within 10 years. The economics support that kind of a change. But it's going to mean that if you look at the hierarchy in a law firm now, with the administrators and the junior lawyers and the intermediate lawyers and, you know, the apprenticeship and, you know, rise to the top of the firm one rung of the ladder at a time, that model's going to have to change because there may not be an economic case for those people in the middle of the firm anymore. So I think the lawyers in particular are going to have a new model for training the top people that doesn't necessarily include spending many years doing the mid-level work. In accounting, to some extent, I mean, in all the knowledge professions, but in accounting, to some extent, that's true as well in terms of the hierarchy of a professional firm. But I think accountants have, to some extent, missed the boat because they, for so many years, have been doing historically based financial statement audits that they've forgotten to sort of look up from their calculators and their adding machines to see that historical based financial statements are probably not long for this earth. The SEC, among other organizations, is pushing for real-time financial disclosure for investors. And I mean, I certainly know if I was going to buy shares of IBM or Microsoft, I would be much more interested in what the financial statements look like yesterday than what they looked like for the year ended December 31st, 2011. And this kind of technology is very rapidly being deployed. It's already developed. There's a technology called XBRL, Extensible Business Reporting Language, which is the basis for real-time reporting by public registrants of the SEC. And you have to stop and ask yourself, what's that going to do to an auditor who's thinking in terms of historically based financial statements? Well, the quick answer is they're not going to care about those historically based financial statements. The auditor of the future is going to have continuous monitoring of their client financial system. They're going to have big data kinds of analysis and their own models to detect transactions that may be inappropriate. They're going to have to assess the environmental controls and the application change controls and the security to make sure that what's posted on IBM's website or the SEC website is accurate. So the accountant is almost going to become a real-time partner or a objective verifier of the real-time disclosure information, not of the historical information. That's going to completely change, has completely changed the skill set that accountants need. They need to be technologists. They need to understand how SAP works. They need to understand why somebody different has to compile the source and develop the source code and what it means to have source in escrow. But these are not things that are being taught to, well, not the mainstream account yet. And one day, it's very soon, it's going to become apparent, I think, to the profession that the curriculum has to change substantially. If you look at the tax practice as well, the practice of tax is very much like practice of law. And again, a lot of the stuff that's done by the mid-level people, the managers, the associates, the administrators, everything except the extremely creative, highest level tax planning, tax analysis, is going to be taken over by smart computers. So how are we going to train the top experts in the next generation? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows in particular. So those are just some of the thoughts I had about technology's impact on the profession. I mean, if you look at things like nanotech, I mean, nanotech is already affecting everything from manufacture to medicine. If you look at the prospects for quantum computing, I mean, talk about disruptive. Quantum computing holds with it the promise of being able to basically secure perfectly information. On the other hand, to crack any existing cryptography. So, you know, the minute quantum computing becomes readily available, everybody's password in the whole world basically becomes known. It's a fairly disruptive change, I would say, as well.
It's interesting. You were talking about the professions, and you mentioned how technology is going to impact the legal profession. I actually have an interview coming up in February, later in February, with Roy Freed, and he's considered the father of computing law, or the application of computers within the legal profession. And he wants to look forward, and our interview is going to sort of focus on how he thinks the human mind is going to be sort of evolving in a sense, or and what that's going to have in terms of impact.
A lot of what I've been reading lately, particularly, for example, from IEEE Artificial Intelligence or IEEE Robotics, is that the relationship between humanity and its computer change, the computer is going to look much more like a smart administrative assistant, maybe even a colleague, than something that supports administrative processes and does dumb calculations for you. And whether that happens in 10 years or 30 years, I don't think anybody knows. But you're seeing a convergence, actually, in between neuroscience and cognitive science and information theory and AI. And the people in brain science are starting to look to the computer people, and the computer people are starting to look to the people in brain science. And people are even starting to talk about conscious computers. And I know they're talking about that since, you know, Mr. Data on Star Trek, but it's no longer as far-fetched as it used to be.
Right, or one of the other areas, I guess, is the social organization and its impact on humanity. And I know that's a sort of a topic dear to you, but, you know, I founded this Global Industry Council, and the chief scientist for Accenture sits on that council. And in a discussion I had with him, he talked about how countries or boundaries are porous, including corporate boundaries are porous. They're really going to disappear because of technology and really all of this sort of social media kind of based technology. And, you know, people aren't going to go to work. They're going to be really project based and they sort of work on their own. And all of those kinds of structures that are in place today are going to disappear. So kind of an interesting, you know, ecosystem we're going to have in the future if you're not going to have corporate boundaries or country boundaries, and everything's going to be really flat, right? So
that's why I so much enjoy future studies and talking to people about their ideas about the future. I don't think anybody really knows, you know, 100 years from now whether humanity's going to be back in Stone Age because of global warming or some cataclysm, or it'll be a new renaissance, a new golden age, or something in between. But there are certainly a lot of opportunities and a lot of challenges for all of us in the next century.
What are your feelings about Kurzweil's singularity? Do you think that that's going to be within our lifetimes, like, let's say, 25, 30 years, or do you think that's 50 to 100 years out, this concept of sort of merging of human brains with computing, and in fact the ability of what makes us who we are being downloaded into some sort of futuristic computer system?
Well, I should start by saying I take almost as many vitamins as he does. So I definitely believe there's some kind of a singularity in medicine. I don't know whether I'm going to survive to see it, but I think there's going to be a point where, you know, if you reach the age of X and you're still in reasonable health, medical science will be able to rejuvenate you, and all of a sudden you're going to have your biological clock reset. With respect to actually downloading human consciousness into computers, I think you're going to see more and more, call them bionic assist. I mean, they're already talking about implanting chip to stimulate the brain, etc. They're talking about implantable cell phones. You're going to carry your cell phone around in a dental filling kind of thing. And that all moves in that direction. But I really think the important part of what Kurzweil says is not so much the merger of humanity and machines as it is when machines become as smart or smarter than humanity, how are we going to interact with them, deal with them, partner with them? You know, if you want to be arrogant, you have to say control them, but at the point where machines are so much smarter than we are, that one is up in the air. So, I mean, I agree that the knowledge curve is exponential. I agree that there will be some reset, for example, in longevity, in medicine. I definitely agree that something big is going to happen, I believe, in technology when you really have thinking machine, smart machine, maybe even conscious machine, that humanity is going to have to renegotiate its place on planet, if you will. But the actual merger and downloading, I don't see that happen for quite a while. And if it does, it's going to be, at least initially, it's going to have to be, obviously, voluntary. I don't see that everybody's going to want to or have to do that.
Or there's cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, or maybe I am, therefore I think. So.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that for Mr. Data, Asimov, and Descartes.
Now, with regards to security, because you are an expert in security, what does this mean, Pandora's box is open?
Oh, well, let's take a bit of historical perspective. I mean, way back when I started doing, let's say, in the 70s, you had mainframe computers and you had a password. And if you were really, you know, state-of-the-art, you put in a program called the ACF2, Access Control Facility 2, or RACF, and that made it harder to bypass passwords, and it locked up the operating system a little bit. You know, that was a very controlled, not really hugely interconnected environment with a huge number of components. Nothing like what we've got today and where we're going. If you look at the number of components that are involved in getting information from one place to another, if you look at the huge amounts of data that are stored, if you look at the complexity of the internet and all the protocols and all the applications and all the operating systems, I mean the first thing that comes to mind is nobody ever wrote a perfect piece of software. So the more stuff there is, the more flaws there are out there. When IBM was the only company that's building mainframes and there was only one operating system, there were a limited number of attack vectors. Now there are an infinite number of attack vectors. Hacking started, you know, in basements, generally with smart kids trying to prove that they were smarter than the computer. Now hacking is organized crime, it's cyber warfare, it's the mob basically kidnapping the wife of a PhD in a certain kind of technology discipline and saying, you will figure out a way to bypass this or we will do something bad to your family. It's a whole different world. The level of threat is orders of magnitude higher, and also the level of dependency that society has is order of magnitudes higher. You know, in the 60s, if every mainframe, if every computer in the world had stopped running, the world would have kept going. Today, if every computer in the world stops running, your lights go out, your food supply probably runs out, your air conditioner doesn't work, you don't do any banking, the financial system collapses. So you've seen over 30, 40, 50 years a huge increase in the number of attack vectors, a huge increase in the sophistication and the financing and the motivation behind the attacks, and a huge increase in society's dependency on all these devices and systems and applications that are being attacked. So that's like a triple whammy, and that's really what I meant when I said to you, Pandora's box is open. The last, I guess, 5, 6, 7 years in particular, we've seen in the security business a really, really big increase in very sophisticated hacks. I mean, the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, the cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities are just one example. I had a friend who was CIO of a financial institution, and his institution was compromised. And before he even knew his institution was compromised, the FBI was on the phone with him. And I thought that was absolutely amazing. But the only reason the FBI knew about it was because they had a mole in the crime organization it was doing. So you've got the top institutions, or among the top institutions in terms of security, not even aware they're being compromised. I find that all quite scary. Security is big crime business now, and the infrastructure is so complex and to some extent so fragile that we really need to think about security, I think, a lot more than we have.
So with regards to security then, what would you say are the five top reasons for security failures?
Again, depends, the accountant's answer depends on circumstances, but I think probably that the top one is still human error. Human error, social engineering, people acting out of complacency or stupidity or greed or ego, that probably underlies 50% of the computer security breaches, the computer crime investigations that I'm involved with. And that's unfortunate, but that's the case. I think a lot of breaches happen because people don't realize how important it is to actually follow the procedures and the controls and the protocol. They think, well, it's easier to do it this way than the secure and the proper way, and there's going to be no harm. And maybe there will be no harm when they do it the first time, second time, the third time, but the fourth time, they may leave a back door open, and the next thing you know, the network's been compromised. And in that regard also, I think the complexity that I spoke of before with respect to components and networks and how machines and applications talk to each other, I think that's a big problem as well. You have to know what transactions you're securing and what processes you're securing and what data you're securing. And I have many, many clients who could not tell you what kind of data they have resident on their system. Or if they do tell you what is resident, they don't know where it is. And if you don't know where it is, which partition, which drive, which directory, which file, which operating system, it's almost impossible to cure. So I'd say complexity and not knowing what needs to be secured is also, it's also an important cause of security failure. Really big one also is sloppy coding, sloppy testing. And I think there's a really interesting movement afoot now in California to make basically a bad computer program a tort. Basically, the idea would be that if you're a software company and you put software out there in the public domain, and as a result of a software error, something bad happened, that the software manufacturer, Microsoft, IBM, whoever, could actually be held liable if that software bug were reasonably foreseeable, or if following proper practices and procedures, they should have detected that software bug in their testing or the development process. The movement is just gaining traction in California now, but if in fact the California legislature passes that law and that starts to catch on, I think you're going to see a lot of software companies much, much more concerned with the quality of the software that they're putting out. So sloppy coding, sloppy testing. Embedded weaknesses, I think, in hardware are also an issue. Hardware and operating software, firmware, things like DNS weaknesses or chips that have inherent weaknesses, operating systems that, are updated, but there's still a bug. There are reasons that Microsoft has patched Tuesday, and every Tuesday there are new patches, because these things, again, are so complex. You fix one thing, and another thing ends up breaking. So that also revolves around complexity, around bad hardware design, software and firmware design, and that would be my last reason. So human error, not following procedures, not understanding the interaction of components, sloppy coding and testing, and just embedded weaknesses because of bad design. Those are my top five.
So if we were to extend this further, then what are your views on digital assets?
Well, digital assets are sort of an unrelated but new and interesting area that I've been working on. Digital assets constitute everything from the IP sitting on a corporate computer to the Linden currency you have in Second Life. There are a number of cryptographic currencies out there. You know, a digital asset is a deposit you have at poker.com. It's, a credit balance you have with PayPal. There are a lot of different kinds of digital assets. A digital asset can be an online business. It can be a blog, a website, a domain name. And the area I've become involved in the last couple of years is basically helping people keep track of these kinds of assets, and in particular working with estate and trust lawyers to make sure that when people are drawing up wills or succession plans, that they consider these kinds of assets as well as the cottage in the Muskokas and the house downtown and the bank account. And it's been been a very eye-opening process, I guess, to some extent for me, as I've met with a number of clients, but certainly for the lawyers and the bankers and the trustees with whom I've dealt, because basically nobody's ever thought that this is something that needs to be done. There's a bit of a burgeoning industry on the internet. Lockbox kind of company will let you store your password, so in case of your death, your passwords are released to your lawyer or your executor or your next of kin. And that's a bit of the tip of the iceberg. It's really a much, much bigger problem than that. I mean, what happens to your web-based friends when you die? How are they notified? What happens to your LinkedIn profile and your Facebook? It's very, you know, unpleasant for a spouse or children to keep getting emails from people who aren't even aware that the deceased is dead. You know, what happens if you've been on the web and you've had avatars or pseudonyms or secondary identities for fun or even for nefarious purposes? What does that do to the family and the lawyer and the executor? What about assets that have been transferred where there's no record anymore? You know, so these are the areas that I deal with in my practice, both at the planning stage with the lawyers and the clients and post-mortem. In particular, where there's been no digital asset plan, there's a lot of investigation and follow-up and following the breadcrumbs required to reconstruct people's digital lives, because that's become so important a part of real life for so many people that you can't really close off someone's estate, can't really close off their relationships and their corporeal life without closing off their digital life as well. So that's basically my view of digital assets and this practice area that we call digital legacy services.
I'm just thinking, though, that you get into identity theft, and if a person has passed on, then identity theft maybe become easier, and then that brings up this whole area of security again.
Absolutely. There are a number of sub-services under digital legacy services, and one of them is identity theft protection, because the minute somebody passes away, they, you know, you publish an obituary and they become a target for identity theft, and you have to establish appropriate monitoring, maybe have agents crawling the web, monitor the credit bureaus, things like that. And there's also a pre-death service, particularly if you're dealing with an elderly person who's maybe not completely comfortable with the internet and not completely capable of evaluating what they're doing. So there's, in essence, that they have, you know, net nanny kind of software, but this is like an elder nanny kind of software to make sure that grandpa doesn't do anything on the web that he shouldn't, while nevertheless letting him have all the flexibility and freedom to talk to his friends, send emails, and, you know, basically be on the web as much as he wants.
Where do you see privacy and security heading, and why?
That's two different questions. Security will become more and more important. It has to, as more and more of our lives and our valuables and our intellectual property are on the web. The modality for security, I think, is going to morph to some extent. I think we're going to see much more biometrics. We have to, simply because, I mean, how many passwords can somebody manage? You know, I think I've probably got 50 passwords, and if you've got 50 passwords, you have to have a spreadsheet where you keep your password, so there goes your security. So I think you're going to see security moving more and more to biometric, or there's a biometric cryptographic hybrid, I've actually forgotten the name right now, that's very interesting, where your fingerprint or your retinal scan actually serves as the seed for a cryptographic algorithm. I think you're going to see a very great increase in your software development and your software development methodology. I just met with a vendor yesterday who has a very, very interesting product in that space that helps companies basically develop and do a security audit at the same time. So at the end stage, the product that they're putting out to the real world is secure, and it's so much easier to do it in the development phase than to try and retrofit. So I think we'll see more of that. We will see heavier and heavier reliance on cryptography until quantum computing arises, and then we're going to have to see the cryptographic security, the mathematical cryptographic security, supplanted by the quantum cryptography. In terms of viruses, I think the idea of a list of signatures and 10 million viruses, I think that's already passé. I think you're going to see more and more whitelisting, which basically means you tell your computer you're authorized to run the following 421 executables, and that's it. And if anything else tries to execute on this system, you just don't let it. Because after a while, it's easier to say those 421 processes or whatever are authorized than every time you're trying to execute something, scan 10 million signatures to say, well, it's not one of the bad ones, so I guess it can go. So I think you're definitely going to see to whitelisting. You're going to see more security as a service, more security monitoring by third parties. It's just becoming too difficult for smaller organizations and for individuals to do. More work on security certification, websites being certified by third parties as secure, and a lot more work on secure architecture. You know, design it in, don't bolt it on after the fact. And there's going to be more and more money put into that too, because cyber warfare is really going to become a serious problem. So many of, they call them the SCADA systems, the infrastructure system, are vulnerable at this point. The water systems and the utility systems and the sewage systems and the transportation systems and even the traffic lights in most major cities, they're all hackable, and they're very, very difficult because of their architecture to secure. You're going to see a lot more focus on those systems as people become really concerned that, you know, society can be knocked back 50 or 100 years simply by turning off the computer through a series of targeted attacks. Now, switching gears and talking about privacy, I am honestly not sure where we're going to go. Really, the big elephant in the room that your privacy specialists don't talk about, who are you trying to be private from and why? And what people don't very often say is, we're trying to be private from the government because we don't necessarily trust the government. And that, I think, particularly in the States, underlies, you know, some of the privacy effort. We're also trying to be private because we've got dignity and because we don't want, you know, our neighbors to know what prescriptions we're on, and because we don't want to be targeted by the most intensive personalized marketing in conceivable, because people have collected our information. I mean, we want to be, privacy is the right to be left alone, and privacy is the right not to be intruded upon by the government. And I think those feelings will continue, but then they start to get all confused with this social media and Twitter and, you know, tweeting, I'm sharing a donut with my sister right now. Well, I mean, that's not being very private. So we may be seeing a divergence between sort of social privacy, commercial privacy, and I'll call it privacy from one's own government. And each of those is going to have, I think, their own economic model. And each of those, I think, is going to be pursued with different levels of vigor. You know, there are privacy laws on the book. The United States is still lagging, but they seem to be catching up. Europe is doing pretty well. But at the end of the day, it's always national security, Trump's privacy. A lot of the time, commercial interest, Trump privacy. But it's not commercial interest. It's the need to create jobs. They won't say commercial interest. They'll say the need to create jobs will trump privacy, et cetera, et cetera. Or you don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think it's like the frog in the boiling water, Steve, to some extent. If you look at what they have now, hundreds of thousands of video surveillance cameras, UK, and people are just used to it now. National DNA databases, and people are just used to it now. So I don't have a huge amount of confidence that 20 years from now we'll have even the same measure of privacy. I think we're going to see very, you know, very much differential privacy, having to pay for privacy. I think people are going to start having to put out dollars if they want to be private, to literally compensate. If you don't want to use my information, then you're going to have to pay me what your information would otherwise have been worth. And I think that's upside down, and I think it's sad, but I think we are moving inexorably towards a surveillance state and a surveillance corporatocracy as well. We're going to have to be very, very careful how we deal with that. The few efforts that are out there, the technological effort, the anonymized browsers, and the individuals having access to cryptography, et cetera, those are interesting, but I don't think any of them are really going to become pervasive. I mean, a really interesting use, I think, of privacy technology is the way they're using cryptography in some of the lesser developed and dictator states where they're basically using cryptography to protect the freedom fighter. And I think that's an interesting use of technology to protect privacy for, you know, greater social benefit. But in the developed world, I'm not as up.
Jerry, you're an international authority in auditing, and I like to get your point of view on this whole computer auditing profession and where it's heading, based on, again, your years and years of experience and in essence being one of, I would say, the founders of this area.
I am fairly optimistic about computer auditing going forward. Not that I'm completely impartial. I see computer security and computer audit coming closer and closer together. I described before the way I think financial state audits are going to become less important, and continuous auditing and monitoring of financial disclosure, modeling, fraud traps, complex analysis of data are going to become more and more important. And those are all parts of computer auditing. I think part of the security solution is going to be third-party assurance. And the only trusted third parties in the security and audit space really are the chartered accountants and the CPAs, the people with professional licenses who stand to lose a very great deal if they certify a system or a website or a business process, and in fact it does have problems. So I see the profession as becoming more technological, more data and process-oriented, much more real-time, very much into complex analysis, terabyte analysis, and really intelligent modeling going forward. And I see a merger between, as I say, security to a lesser extent, privacy, computer audit, and providing assurance right through the development cycle, right through to the end application, sort of third-party certification.
What are the top five reasons for auditing failures?
Actually, I read that question when you sent it to me, and I wasn't sure whether you meant a company failing because of a bad audit or an auditor failing to do a bad job. I'm going to answer both. One of the top reasons is something we call management override. An auditor is supposed to be skeptical, but not necessarily paranoid. And in many of the cases where the audit hasn't detected something which it should have, it's been a case that senior management basically overrides controls that otherwise would have been effective. And that's based on greed and stupidity and arrogance in the corporate environment to some extent. Sometimes it happens with an owner manager, and sometimes it happens in a huge organization such as Enron, for example. Huge audit failure. I mean, from the auditor's perspective, auditors have this phrase, they say, isolated incident, and they use that as a reason not to follow up. Well, a lot of the times when people say isolated incident, it really isn't. And I think it's the time pressures. You have to complete the audit. You have so many hours, and this is the deadline. So you don't necessarily want to follow up something that is possibly a small clue and possibly nothing. And I think that's been cause of some audit failures as well, just not looking at the evidence objectively enough because of the time, the administrative pressures to get the audit completed. I mean, I think in general, auditors historically haven't been skeptical enough, but that changed the last 4 or 5 years, I think, with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, people seeing how important audits are, and with the shareholders, particularly of public companies, demanding more accountability, and with auditors being sued pretty well all the time for audit failures. I think auditors have of their own accord become more skeptical, and the professional institutes and the accepted standards have also moved towards auditors being much more skeptical with respect to evidence, believing what senior management tells you, getting independent confirmation, etc. And again, in that regard, sampling is always an issue in auditing as well, and there's a huge divide in the auditing profession between the statistical samplers and the heuristic samplers, and I guess there are a few in the hybrid category. But deciding, you know, if you've got an organization, a huge multinational enterprise with literally millions and millions of transactions, and you have to test a business process or a transaction stream, how many transactions are you going to look at? 10, 100, 1,000, a million? Well, the auditors have different ways of determining that. And, you know, you could conceivably look at a million transactions if you had an automated tool. You obviously can't look at a million if you're doing it manually. So I think sample size determination and sample size in relation to the extent that audit tools are automated has been and continues to be a bit of an issue. There are some reasonable standards. There's always going to be some statistical possibility, not probability, that the auditor's sample size is not sufficient or not appropriate, or the universe hasn't been identified correctly, the sampling universe hasn't been identified correctly, so that the auditor looks at some items or some transactions and they seem to be fine, but in fact something doesn't smell right in Denmark. And that also comes down to the way auditors analyze their results, their sampling results, and there's a tendency not to see the forest for the trees. And that's because these audits, or many audits, have become so immense that you have individuals who focus on tiny, tiny segments of the business or the financial statements and really don't see things in context. And I think also, to some extent, medicine has recognized that as a problem. You're seeing specialties and subspecialties and sub-subspecialties, and people aren't looking at the whole patient. And that's really where the best diagnosis can be made, at the level of the whole patient. With auditing, it's similar. At the level of the whole enterprise, that's where you make your best audit judgment, but that's not the way many audits constituted. So those are a number of reasons I see for audit failure.
Okay, we're going to shift directions a bit here and talk about professionalism and what that means. So is professionalism necessary and why?
Professionalism is absolutely necessary. And the why is because when you look at what definition of a profession is, that's, you know, one of the foundations, I think, of a society. And a profession is a body of knowledge, an agreed way to apply the body of knowledge, ethics and standards, ensuring that training for the people who are doing whatever we're talking about is appropriate, certification, recertification, there may be an exclusive right to practice, and all of that is very necessary for doctors and lawyers and accountants and engineers, people upon whom many, many people rely for very important things. You wouldn't want an unprofessional, uncertified, untrained engineer spending $3 billion to build a bridge across a river, only to have it collapse a month later because they weren't properly trained. You wouldn't want a surgeon to operate on you or one of your family members if that surgeon hadn't been trained and vetted and tested by some third-party organization. And who is the third-party organization except the professional institute, the College of Physicians, the Law Society, whatever? Professionalism, I think, is absolutely essential with a capital P, but equally essential with a small p. Because with a small p, professionalism means the individual takes responsibility for the quality of the work, doesn't look at the clock, they look at the result, considers their client's interest above their own interest, is committed to doing the best possible job in circumstances, takes responsibility for their own training and knowledge, and won't even accept an engagement if they don't have the training and the knowledge. So small p professionalism is basically another way of saying being very grown up and doing a good job, and big p professionalism is the way society protects itself and assures that the really important things are done properly, and if they're not, someone is there to be held accountable.
Is there a role for professional certification, and why?
Absolutely, again. Professional certification doesn't necessarily, by the way, mean exclusivity of right to practice. And information technology is a great area to explore that. But certification basically means a third-party organization, presumably objective and at arm's length, has said this individual has certain skills, knowledge, practical experience, ethical standards, has passed the exam, and has committed to maintain standards going forth at the risk and the penalty of losing their certification if they don't. I mean, that to me seems like an excellent way to ensure quality. And as I said, in technology, for example, you have certified information technology professionals, and Canadian Information Processing Society is one organization that grants certification. And you have uncertified people who work in the field. And nothing says, all things being equal, that an uncertified IT professional with comparable experience, education, ethics, etc., is not going to do as good a job. Absolutely nothing says that. But if you're an employer or a regulator and you want some assurance of that, how are you going to get assurance? By looking at a guy's CV and saying, well, that CV is equivalent to the certified guy's CV? Well, maybe. But it seems to me certification is a very short and effective way to do all the preliminary research, rather, ensure that someone is qualified to do work, and a lot easier than doing all the legwork and checking all the references and making sure that the CV is accurate, so that the guy who's not certified but has equal skill is given the same consideration. Certification is, you know, important at another level also. I mean, professions have certification to protect the public because, again, these same two individuals, and let's say in IT, one of whom is certified and one of whom is not, the certified professional does something wrong. He stands to be sanctioned, to lose his license, be penalized financially or otherwise, to have his name published in the paper. The uncertified professional does something wrong, may or may not get fired, but the repercussions are a lot less. So the certified professional, in reality, has much more skin in the game because they've much more invested in the certification and much more to lose. Another aspect of certification is the third-party component, where you've got an institute of professionals, the Canadian Information Processing Society, the College of Physician Surgeons, whatever. You have a big organization with a governance structure in place, basically standing behind the work. As an end consumer, I think that gives me much more comfort. As a member of the public, it gives me much more comfort. And the institute or the organization provides a mechanism for my protection if, for whatever reason, I'm unhappy with how the professional has been acting. So I think that's another part of the third-party certification.
Jerry, you brought up this idea of the role of a third party being involved in the certification process. So this kind of naturally leads to this question, and is what is the value of professional association for a computing professional?
Well, I just answered the question in part. A professional association like the IEEE, the British Computer Society, KIPS in Canada, the Canadian Information Processing Society. The association supports and maintains the body of knowledge. They administer the discipline and the complaint management process. They advocate for the profession and for the professional. They have the examinations and the recertification process so that at the end of the day, if you're a computer professional and you want to differentiate yourself, you may have all the technical skills that your neighbor does, but the fact that you've become a member of this professional association and gone the extra mile to get the certification mean to your employer and to the public that you're willing to put more on the line, basically. You're willing to put more on the line with respect to the quality of your work, the extent to which you can be relied upon, the ethics by which you conduct yourself than someone who hasn't gone through the certification process or hasn't become a member of a professional society. And the professional societies provide so much more. They provide networking opportunities, educational opportunities, you know, a starting point for research. You know, if you're a computer professional and you've got a problem with a government regulation or with anything basically related to the professional, you know, chances are you're not going to have the time or the wherewithal to go testify before a parliamentary committee. But you can write a letter to your professional society, and if enough people write letters saying approximately the same thing, your professional society will go and testify in front of the parliamentary committee and make known your views on that particular matter. And I know I've been involved, at least peripherally, in some of that work. And the government does listen. They do change draft legislation. They do alter or eliminate regulations that enough people think are inappropriate or counterproductive. So professional association gives an individual practitioner a much larger voice. So it's a little bit like being part of a university and a little bit like being part of a club, and you know, it's got so many benefits that really I find it hard to understand why someone who devotes full time to technology or really to any profession wouldn't want to be part of the professional association that manages and regulates that work.
So let's extend that question then into Canada, and can you specifically talk about the value of KIP?
Well, KIPS is both a national and a provincial organization. In Canada, it's the only IT professional association that has actually been mandated by statute in the law. It does everything that I mentioned previously. It's a forum for knowledge sharing. It manages a body of knowledge. It has a disciplinary process, a certification process. KIPS accredits university programs so that students very early on can be inculcated into a professional way of doing things and a professional way of looking at their work. I mean, we have thousands of members across Canada. KIPS provides a great opportunity for networking and for employers. It provides a great sort of central clearinghouse if an employer is looking for a certain kind of professional. I mean, there are some people who would say that having a certification, being a member of HIP would lead to higher salary, you know, more chance of promotion. We certainly don't have any statistic to confirm that, but I think anecdotally that's the case. You know, two identical candidates, one of whom is certified and a member of HIP and the other who isn't. I suspect HIP's member probably has a better chance of moving forward in their career. Another thing is that KIPPS is different from sort of other computer-related organizations in its focus on ethics and professionalism. KIPPS doesn't provide technical certification per se. You don't join KIPPS to become a network administrator or a security professional or a specialist in Unix. When you get certified by KIPPS, and KIPPS has two certifications, the IFP, the Information Systems Professional, and the ITCP, the Information Technology Certified Professional, which is an international designation. When you get either of those designations, it's basically a statement that you understand technical and technological processes, but you also understand the intersection between business, user need, processes, and technology. A KIPPS certified professional has a technical view and a broader view, and I think that's one of the special values of the KIPPS certification. And as far as I'm aware, there aren't other certifications that really play in that interstices, in that space that's not only technical and technological, but also business and also strategic. When you apply for KIPPS membership, we look at your whole career. We don't look at the fact that, you know, you've taken 27 technical courses. We look at your experience as a developer, and we look at your experience as a manager, and we look at your experience as a researcher, if that's the case, or as an academic, and we assess the whole individual before we even let people sit the examination, never mind award the designation or both of the designations. So that's pretty well KIPPS. KIPPS has been around in Canada for 60 years, and I like to think the organization is constantly scanning the horizon and trying to renew itself. Right now, KIPPS is again trying to renew itself, recognizing that the next generation of people are different kinds of IT professionals. When I joined KIPPS in the 80s, there wasn't such a thing as a social network or a microcomputer or the internet. And today, the average high school student is probably nearly as literate as a computer professional was 30 years ago. So we have to look at our definition of what constitutes being a computer professional and what the appropriate body of knowledge is, and what's the balance between technical and technological and business or societal kind of experience and maturity. And we're constantly rebalancing our requirements and constantly trying to update our certifications and our body of knowledge to meet society's requirements today and hopefully society's requirements tomorrow as well.
I guess it just sort of reminds me, in my research, I find that KIPPS is sort of at the founding of so much. I mean, they were at the founding of the International Federation, which is a UN affiliated kind of body. In fact, they're the consultative body to the United Nations in IT. And, you know, KIPPS, one of KIPPS's first presidents was the founder of all the graduate education programs in computing science here in Canada and the undergraduate programs in computing science here in Canada. KIPPS members have been at sort of the start of privacy legislation in the government and policies and so on. So really at the founding of many of the things that are happening not only nationally but also internationally.
I agree with you, Stephen. I think Canada definitely punches above its weight class on the international stage when it comes to information technology professionalism and standards and being at the forefront of changes that are moving IT from being a new profession to being a more mature profession.
We're going to broaden now sort of the scope here in this next question. And what specific challenge and opportunity should IT practitioners and businesses embrace today and into the future?
You know, you're asking me to put my futurist hat on again. I think the hot topic, the important areas today, certainly the integration and alignment of systems and business processes. Gone are the days when IT was a back office support function and a silo. And a lot of business, fortunately, are still thinking about their IT that way, and they need to move to bring IT into the forefront of this strategy to see information as part of their product or their marketing process or their measurement process or their strategic process or more likely all of those processes. So, I mean, today IT needs to become a full partner and all corporate information has has to be effectively. I mean, we hear about data mining, which is really only the tip of the iceberg. Big data analytics, and IBM is very much involved in that, and that's very interesting. We're seeing this new job category, data scientists, emerge, where companies are able to use, you know, much of their data that they previously ignored or couldn't capture to focus their business strategy, to enhance their profitability, etc. So those are all areas where today's businesses need to focus. I think communications and mobile technology, virtual desktop, use of the cloud, and those are fairly well known, and those are technologies that are going to become only more important. Some of the problems that are keeping like cloud computing and mobile computing from really exploding are of a due diligence and a legal nature, and I think once those problems are resolved, see a very, very rapid decentralization of processing and moving the process to the into the cloud. We mentioned security and privacy before. These are two components that cannot be left behind, even though unfortunately fairly frequently they are. So if you're running a business or an organization, university, you have to keep your security and your privacy in mind, or you will have your systems taken down, or you will lose your intellectual property, or you will end up disclosing private and confidential information in breach of a statute, or your financial asset compromise. Someone will literally steal money out of your bank. So those would be some of the areas I would focus on today. 5 years from now, I think you're going to see all of those trends that I mentioned still active. You'll see the artificial intelligence and the expert systems much more prominent in complex analysis and business process management. I think 5, maybe 10 years now, you're also going to see the issue of who is in control and who should be in control becoming much more important. And by that I mean today, for example, there's network monitoring software which provides support to the network manager who actually does the network manage. 5, 10 years from now, I think you may see network monitoring software which does the network manage, and the network manager, if he's still employed, just reviews or periodically looks in to make sure that it's being done. So I think you can see a bit of a change in the locus of control, is what they call it. With AI and expert systems go knowledge management, data analysis, all of that is going to be really, really important 5 years from now. It's going to be important, and to some extent it's going to be assumed. It's going to be assumed that you use your data in the most effective way, and you know what trends are there, even if the trends are not important. Because if you're not doing it, your competitor will be doing it, and you're going to find yourself at a significant disadvantage. 5 years from now, seamless interface, much more ubiquitousness in computing, even though that may seem impossible at this point, perpetual connectivity, and really more moving towards this new form of society where everyone talks to everyone and there are different tranches, different styles and types of privacy, and connectivity, more choice. So that would be my prognostication for 5 years from now.
Jerry, you're one of the most eclectic world leaders I've ever interviewed, so we're going to go into a slightly different direction again because of the depth of your background, and this whole question is about entrepreneurship. So I know you've worked in the entrepreneurial area, you've done startups, we're going to mine some of that experience, and I know people in the audience want to become entrepreneurs, so let's mine that experience. How does one engage investors?
One takes them out to supper and buys them a nice bottle of wine and buys a large diamond ring and asks politely, "Will you marry me?" That was a joke, Stephen. I think engaging investors is a fairly complex process. You have to have an owner or an inventor who has a really good idea, who is enthusiastic and can convey the enthusiasm. I think that's a prerequisite. The owner or the person doing the pitch to the investors has to be a pretty good presenter, quick on their feet, and able to answer questions. A lot of people fall down with respect to the business plan and the cash flow, which are essential, certainly for venture capital investors, maybe not so much for angel investors. And then there's a whole issue of having a vision as to where you want your company to be a year from now and 2 years from now and 5 years from now. But it has to be a vision that both resonates and is realistic. It has to be a fairly obvious path from here to the vision. And part of that path has to be the kind of team that you either have put together or are intending to put together. I think investors are as interested in the people and the track record of the people in the company as they are in the specific technology or invention, because many, many businesses with great invention fail because the team is not good, not experienced, not sufficiently diverse, doesn't work well enough together. On the other hand, a mediocre idea can become a viable business with the proper people, you know, managing the business. I think credibility and track record, if you can manage to bring that onto your team, are also important in engaging investors. And looking for investors who are not only people going to write you a check, but also people who can provide guidance and even hands-on assistance as required, very important. The most successful startups, the most successful businesses that I have seen, audition. They select their investors. They don't just take anybody with money. They say, you will be a good investor because an investor is going to be part of our advisory team, part of our business going forward. We don't want someone whose only objective is, you know, A, B, and C, when the company's objective is obviously D, E, and F. So selecting your investors and not being so desperate for cash as you are desperate for mentorship, guidance, people who know the industry, people who are well connected and have money, not people just who have money and willing to put it into your idea. So that's what I'd say about engaging investors. Angel networks are really good. LinkedIn is really good. I've raised many millions of dollars with a very few phone calls. You just have to take the time and the effort to get the people to get to know the people either who are the investors or who know the prospective investors.
We're down to our last two questions, and these are going to be a little bit more freeform in their nature. So I know you've traveled a lot and you speak a lot, and you worked with many different people around the world, world leaders, and all of the things that you've done with great success. So you must have some stories to share, maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, and so on.
I think I've got a few lesson stories that I learned over the years. I'm going to take one from each of the sort of three or four major parts of my career. And the first one relates to when I was a trustee in bankruptcy. I met a gentleman. He was actually a world-class physician. He was earning about $700,000 a year, and he was in my office to file for bankruptcy. And I looked at his numbers, and his finances, and I could not figure out why this world-class doctor making $700,000 a year was filing for bankruptcy. And I looked at his expenditures, and they seemed a little bit out of line, but not extraordinary out of line. And then it turned out he hadn't been paying his income taxes for many, many years, and he owed millions and millions of dollars in income taxes. And he didn't really have a cogent explanation for why. So he filed for bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy process sometimes goes on for years. And I guess over the years, I got to know him and then eventually his wife some more. And I think it was 2 or 3 years into the bankruptcy that I had, he was in my office and his wife as well. And his wife, as it turned out, was from an extremely wealthy family and was a very, very beautiful woman. And I don't even recall what we were talking about, but I asked more on a friendly basis than as a trustee. I asked, why again did this happen? Why did you not pay your taxes? And why, even though you were making almost $1 million a year, did you let this happen to you? And in a moment of honesty or insight, the doctor said to me, basically, he looked at his wife and he said, I was afraid of losing my wife. And she looked back at him, absolutely shocked. What are you talking about? And he proceeded to explain how his wife came from a background, multi-millionaire background, and he only made $700,000 a year. And he was only a doctor, and she was, you know, an exquisitely beautiful woman. And he was afraid that if he didn't, you know, let her live in the style to which she had been accustomed and take her to the most expensive resort and send the children to absolutely the very best school, that she might leave him. And he started crying. And she started crying. And it was a really cathartic moment. But she basically said to him, that's not true. That's never been true. I didn't marry you for a lifestyle. And you could see on his face that the realization that for probably the last 10 or 15 years, he had been torturing himself, trying to meet some ideal that he thought his wife held, and operating on the basis of insecurity, even though he was a top doctor in the world, and even though he was making so much money. And it was all for absolutely nothing. nothing, that his bankruptcy was all for absolutely nothing. And I have never, never forgotten that moment and that situation, because it goes to show how people make assumptions, sometimes very, very bad assumptions, rather than just ask. In this case, he didn't ask his wife. And people, no matter how well-to-do or how poor, have a tendency to judge themselves in relation to what they think should be the standard and what they think should be appropriate. So if you're making $700,000 a year and you think you should be making $5 million a year, you feel poor. On the other hand, I recall having had a client with five children who made $25,000 in a year, and I swear I have rarely seen an individual so happy. And she managed her life and she managed her children, and the fact that she barely had enough money didn't matter, because she had figured out, between using the food banks and doing babysitting and all the rest, how to survive. So the message is communication. Make sure your assumptions are correct. And really, happiness comes from inside, not from measuring yourself against others. So that's my first story, and I don't know whether it's amusing or surprising or unexpected, but it stayed with me for many, many years. The second story I'd like to tell you is about a number of my engagements with the government. And I'm thinking of a couple with large crown corporations, and at least one with a provincial government. And I think, again, it's an issue of communication, but it's also an issue of being afraid to rock the boat, being afraid to communicate. In all three cases I was in doing some kind of a computer study or financial analysis or assessment of efficiency, or trying to determine whether the government was spending their money correctly, appropriately, reasonably. And in all three cases, the answer was a resounding no. And there are a lot of people in the audience, a lot of people among the listeners, who will not be surprised at that. And I wasn't surprised at the results either. What did really bother me, though, was that in all three cases, we developed a report, recommendation for improvement, gave ideas on how to make things better. And sometimes they were out of the box. Most of the time, they were in the box. And in all three cases, the reports were filed away in the drawer and not addressed because of political consideration, because of vested interest in the bureaucracy, because people were afraid that jobs would be lost, because people were afraid that these reports would be used not as documents, blueprints for improvement, but as weapons in a battle for position and status. And that throughout my career has very, very sad, to the point where I really think twice now about even doing work for government, because even though most of the people I come across in the civil service and the government are extremely hardworking and extremely well-meaning and very qualified, the system itself sometimes tends to be not supportive of positive change, and so imbued with this overriding need to consider politics first and foremost, that, you know, the scientific efficiencies and the financial efficiencies and technological efficiencies and processes that could and should be implemented are just overlooked. So that's my government story. The last story is going to be from my consulting to startup. And a story of a father and a son who came to my office and wanted to start a business. And they had an idea. And we worked with them for many months to try and develop this idea. And it went through many different incarnations, and we had many different specialists involved. But at the end of the day, it didn't move forward. The business idea didn't move forward. And the reason it didn't move forward was because we couldn't find a way to make it work without spending millions of dollars up front. And obviously, 99% of startups don't have millions of dollars to access up front. And I think the lesson I took from that is that startups oftentimes need to bootstrap, and one's assessment of what's acceptable risk in an operating business with a reputation might not be the same as what's acceptable risk in a company that's just trying to get out there in front of customers. I mean, it's really a situation where you have to decide what's good enough versus what's perfect, and it may be one of the situations in business and in life where it is difficult, but you have to decide, I'm not going to do things in the best way, or even the second best way, or in third best way. I'm going to do it in the cheapest, quickest way, even though I know I'm going to have to redo it, because if I don't start that way, I'm never going to have a business at the end. So I'll call that the lesson of startup and pragmatism and startups and risk assessment. Fifth as sort of my third story.
Jerry, I love the stories and some really great lessons from each one of the stories. Probably some of the best stories I've ever heard, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now we are down to our very last question, and this is where I turn the tables. And, you know, we've covered a lot of different areas and topics and domains in this interview. But what have I missed? In other words, what questions would you ask if you were doing the interview, and then what would be your answer?
Well, the obvious one. Why did you jump around so much from being a geek at MIT to going to medical school to joining an accounting firm and then trying to turn them upside down with technology to then being a privacy guy, a bankruptcy trustee, an artist? Why all the jumping around? And which commended to your children? So that's the question I would ask, and I want to answer it if I'm. The answer is, I've led a life that's been, I think, open to circumstance and opportunity. For example, I went to art school because all of my life, and this was in my 40s, all of my life I'd loved art, and I had good friends who were artists, and I'd always been their assistants and floated around the periphery of being an artist. And there was a time when it was actually my time at the City of Toronto as one of their consultants. I had a sufficient income that I literally only had to work a day a week. So rather than saying, well, that's great, I have 4 other days to go out and make more money, I said, what can I do with 4 days a week that I've wanted to do all my life and never been able to because I've had a job? And the answer at that point was, go to art school. I went. I loved it. I never regretted a moment. And the fact that my contract with City ended and I had to go back to work 5 days a week after that, doesn't matter. What matters is I had an opportunity for a couple of years to do something that I really wanted, and I took it. With respect to getting into accountancy, for example, that was honestly an accident. After medical school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to do something worthwhile. I liked helping people. And a friend got me the job at Pricewaterhouse. Really, I went to the interview hoping I was going to blow the interview. I didn't want to be an accountant, but I got the job despite myself. So as I said, after 6 months or a year, I said, well, I might as well make this interesting and might as well make some improvements. And that's when I started to work on the computer audit kind of technology. Same thing after I left Pricewaterhouse. I was really, really into research at that point, and I didn't want to go into a strictly corporate environment. And the best I could do at that point was to start my own firm that was, to some extent, very research-oriented, because this was in the early 90s and the mid-90s. There wasn't a lot going on with privacy and cryptography from the commercial sense and the use of biometrics. So I followed my instinct, my scientific instinct, and my research instinct. I became involved as a trustee completely by accident, but it was an opportunity that presented itself. And I'd never liked accounting. I always thought accounting was boring. But when I found trustee work, being a trustee was like being a private detective and a lawyer and a social worker and a psychologist and a judge and a jury. And every engagement was different. And every engagement actually affected somebody's life. And for many years, that was intoxicating, particularly considering how removed one is as an auditor or even a consultant or a researcher. So I had the opportunity, and I was fortunate. I had some good background training. I didn't go through the trustee program, which is a many, many year training program. I simply went in one day and sat the exam, and I passed it. So I got my license, and for many years after that, I worked as a trustee. And what finally got me back into the technology assurance was, again, circumstance and opportunity. The firm with which I was associated had a big, big client, a multi-billion-dollar audit. And the regulatory people had told them, you have to have some computer audit here. And I trepidatiously raised my hand, still being a trustee at that point, said, I know how to do that stuff, and the rest is history. So I keep doing things as long as they're interesting. If an opportunity presents itself, like art school, and I'm able to, I take it. I'm not afraid of changing careers. I mean, I'm not afraid of being a consultant or a researcher or an author or an accountant or a trustee or a technologist, because I've always had faith, and I thank my parents for this. I've always had faith that if I don't know something, I can learn it, and that if you have a framework of rationality and look at problems, you'll be successful more often than not. So would I recommend jumping around to my children? Not per se, but I do tell them all the time that you need to do something that is engaging, something that you really love, and if that means changing careers once or twice or 3 times, go for it. So that's the first question and the first answer. The second one, I think, has to do with what I think in my career has been really the most satisfying on a personal level. And I have to say, because of who I am, it's been the helping component of being a trustee and the teaching component, because I've taught at universities and I've taught professional courses and I've mentored quite a lot. And that's been very, very satisfying to me as well. And my recent activities the last 4 or 5 years with KIPP in terms of helping the organization and help the profession and being able to exercise my leadership skills has been very satisfying as well. And my last question to myself is, what do I hope to do in the next 20 to 30 years? And I should tell your audience that I am a very mature person. I am 60 years old and I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old at home. So I, in fact, am very hopeful that I'm going to have a 20 or a 30 year window and career ahead of me. And the answer is, continue just what I'm doing. I'm focusing more and more on startups because I find them very exciting. There's a lot I have to offer in terms of wisdom, organization, financing, investors, introduction to basically the world of entrepreneurship. I really enjoy building businesses, and I intend to continue to build technology assurance services where I am now as much as I can. I'm very interested in the digital legacy services as well. That's an area, and it really is an area that I'm on the ground floor of. Some people even think I've essentially created it, but I think that's a growing area, and I've spent some time there. And I hope also to have some time in the next couple of decades, given my health, hopefully to spend some time and watch my children grow up.
Now, sometimes, Jerry, I forget how old you are because you look like 42 or something like that. So.
Well, anybody listening to this interview, please don't tell my age. Thank you. It'll be our secret.
Well, Jerry, you've taken on this, or taken us, the audience, on just a great journey, and I want to thank you for coming in today. I know your schedule is very demanding, and we are indeed fortunate that you've been able to share so many of your insights, your experiences, your history of global success with the audience. So thank you again.
My pleasure, Stephen, and thank all your listeners for taking the time to listen to what I have to say as well.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jerry Gertner, international leader in IT security and forensics, governance, and auditing.